This is the Art of the Hudson Valley, WGXC, 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, Greene, and Columbia Counties, New York, broadcasting locally on 90.7 FM and globally online at WGXC.org. And I'm your host, Chad Weckler, for this month's edition of the Art of the Hudson Valley. And today, our guest is David Black, a local writer from Columbia County. David's an award-winning journalist, a novelist, a screenwriter, and producer. He has published 9 books. Actually, he just told me it's 11 books already, and over 150 articles. He has also written for the stage, screen, and television. Among the television shows he has produced and written are 100 Center Street, The Education of Max Bickford, The Cosby Mysteries, Miami Vice, Monk, Cop Shop, Hill Street Blues, Law and Order, and I could go on with an additional list. His novels include The Plague Years, Peep Show, Like Father, The King of Fifth Avenue, An Impossible Life, and The Extinction Event. Welcome, David.
I'm glad to be here.
Let's go to the beginning. When did you begin writing?
In the beginning, there was the word. I don't remember when I began writing, but I began trying to get published when I was 7 years old. I was sending articles and essays, short ones, out to Martin Levin's The Phoenix Nest on the old Saturday Review.
Wow.
Obviously, nothing I wrote was anywhere near ready to get published, and it took a couple of decades before I finally did get published. But I kept writing all the way through.
Were you typewriting or handwriting?
No, I would handwrite, and my father, who encouraged me, would do a typescript copy of what I would handwrite.
What did your father do for a
vocation? He started out in an orphanage in Boston, and he was a jazz musician and poker player who worked his way through 11 years of college, ending up speaking fluently about 16 languages and being pretty much able to get through any Indo-European language. He couldn't do Finnish and Hungarian and Basque, but...
So you grew up in Boston?
No, I grew up in Springfield. My parents moved to Springfield, Massachusetts in 1947 because of the Springfield Plan, which was the country's first court-mandated integrated school project.
So from those early years, under 10, submitting, when did you finally decide you wanted to be a professional writer?
That's when I started sending it out. Although I was a child, a kid actor for many, many years, professional kid actor, and was in equity stock companies, and had my swan song in off-Broadway production at the Writer's Stage Theater on East 3rd Street in New York that got terrific reviews, and I figured I'm never going to do better than this, and I quit.
Oh, why did you quit?
I was waiting backstage for a show after the off-Broadway production, and it was like a switch went off, and suddenly it was all over.
No joy?
No joy, only panic.
Panic's not the way to live one's life.
No, but unfortunately I became a freelance writer, which is nothing but panic. And then I got into TV, and that's panic times 10.
When was your first book that you wrote?
Well, I wrote 6 novels that were not published before I got my first published, and 2 nonfiction books that were not published before I got my first book published. One of the non-published books, Anthony Burgess, who I had known when I first went to New York, campaigned to get Knopf to publish it, and his editor at Knopf finally wrote him a letter saying, "Is this the kind of book that you think deserves a Borzoi imprint? It sounds like it was written under the influence of some sort of drug." Mm. And so Burgess, since he knew I was broke, offered to collaborate on an obscene novel. We would alternate chapters because it was during the early 70s, and there were a bunch of people who were authors who were doing that. There was one called Here Came the Stranger, or something like that. Mm. There was 13 novelists, And we each got about two chapters in and then realized that we just couldn't stop giggling. So,
is there only one, well, for you, only one way to write? Do you write from the get-go, from the beginning, and then continue and let the story build? Or do you have an idea of the story before you start writing?
I always have an idea before. My novels, I don't outline. But the novels, I usually know where I'm starting, and I usually have the last line in mind. Even if it takes 5 years to write it, the last line is pretty much where I'm aiming. For television and movies, I always outline, and I outline a lot, just because it's collaborative and you don't want to have any surprises. You don't want to, especially if you're doing weekly television series, you don't want to have a script that goes in and everyone says, you know, this is what we had in mind. One of the features I wrote for Court Madden, they wanted me to do Friends crossed with the African Queen, kind of extreme sports with a bunch of young people. And they had a pretty, very good track record. I think they had about 50 or 60 hits. And I thought, this is great, because it was also a kind of movie that could be turned into an amusement park ride. And I saw riches in the future. But when I brought the, and I hadn't outlined a lot. I had a rough outline, but it was really just what happens next, not the content of the scenes or how the scenes would be played. And when I sent it in, they flew me out to LA to discuss the draft, the first draft. And I walked in and Robert Court said, "We got some good news and bad news. Which do you want first?" And I said, "Well, give me the bad news first." And he said, "Well, we wanted Friends crossed with the African Queen, and you gave us Friends crossed with Long Day's Journey into Night." I said, "Well, okay. What's the good news?" He said, "I really like your tie."
That was it.
That was it. So I now do, if it's a hour-long script, which is around 50 to 60 pages, depending on how much action or how talky it is, my outline can be 20 to 30 pages long. Not just what happens next, but the content of the scenes, the emotional development of the scenes, the character development all the way through the arc of the project.
Can we talk about Law and Order a little bit? It's a very well-known series and franchise for television, and I would say everybody knows about Law and Order. How you got involved in writing?
My first job in television, I was fairly old for a novice, because I had a fairly active career as a journalist and novelist. And I was visiting a friend of mine who had just gotten a job in Hill Street Blues. I was doing an article for Playboy in Los Angeles. And one of the executives, David Milch, had read one of my books and said, "You want to write a script?" And I said, "Sure." And a few weeks later, came in with the script, and he said, "Well, call your wife, tell her you'll be back in 10 months. You got a job."
Oh, wow.
And one of the previous Hill Street writers who had gone the year I started to Miami Vice, Dick Wolf, got to be pals, and he was really my mentor in the business. Mm. And even though I knew stage acting, I didn't know a lot about screen or TV acting. And Dick hired me on Miami Vice the year after Hill Street, which was wonderful. I got to drive the cigarette boat. And then he and I worked together for 6 or 7 years on various series, subsequently, including the year Law and Order started, two other series, Nasty Boys and H.E.L.P., which was like later on, Third Watch was a version of what we did. And H.E.L.P. was a wonderful show. It had a great cast, John Mahoney, Wesley Snipes, David Caruso, wonderful actors. And Law and Order was a show that had been turned down by all of the then four networks. Mm. And NBC finally programmed it because they wanted to do another show Dick and I had developed called Nasty Boys. And for 3 or 4 years, it was in danger of being canceled every year. And who knew that 20 years later, kids who were born after Law and Order started would be getting out of college.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
The structure of writing for television and writing for film, is it different?
Yes. Typically, and these are all, there's no, you know, decalogue, no Ten Commandments brought down from in some on high. They're just rough rules of thumb that writers and producers tell each other as they're in the business. But typically, a movie is a three-act structure. Act one, originally movies from the 40s, the acts might be more balanced, about the same length. Today, an act one could be as short as 6 minutes, just the setup. And a long act two, and then a chase sequence in act three. Unfortunately, most act threes are pretty standard. You could switch around from one movie to another. Mm-hmm. Act ones tend to be the most interesting because it's the setup. Mm-hmm. And act twos can, if you don't have a good script and good actors and a good director, can be deadly dull. I worked with Sidney Lumet for 2 years on 100 Center Street. And I screened all of the movies he had directed, and I think Sidney's one of the 10 greatest directors in the history of film. And you go through his films, and no matter how many you remember, there's always an equal number you forgot that are all masterpieces, mm-hmm. from 12 Angry Men through to Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, which he did when he was, I think, 83, and was one of his best movies. And when I watched Prince of the City the second time through, there is a scene at the very beginning when Treat Williams, the star, leaves a barbecue and takes his brother up into an attic of his house, and they get into a fight, and Treats pushes his brother, who hits his head against the wall, and his head leaves a mark, an indentation in the wallboard. Mm. And on the second screening, I noticed the indentation was there before the guy's head hit the wall from a previous take. And the next day in work, I said, Sidney, why didn't you just take some time to change the wallboard? Sidney was famous for, they say, direct on roller skates. He was possibly the fastest director, certainly the fastest director I know about, in Daniel, from the Book of Daniel. He did two crowd scenes involving over 300 extras, one in Union Square and the other in a assembly hall, and did them both in one day. Mm. Another director might take weeks to do that. Anyway, so I knew why Sidney didn't replace the wallboard, but it seemed, in that case, you should have. And Sidney said, you don't think this is the first time they've had that fight, do you?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And then he said, what's arguably the most famous scene in cinema history? And I said, well, I don't know. I could have been a contender between Brando and Rod Steiger and On the Waterfront. And he said, that's right. And he said, describe the scene to me. I said, well, it's two guys sitting in a taxi, not even standing, sitting with a camera on stilts filming them. No action. Usually the camera has to be moving, or the actors, mm-hmm. or both. But this is no action. Just two guys talking. And it is brilliant, because you had a brilliant script, mm-hmm. brilliant actors, and a brilliant director. And then he said, what was behind their heads? Do you remember the movie?
I would say, wasn't it the rear window of the automobile? The
taxi?
Yeah.
Okay. And what was in the rear window?
I would say nothing.
We all remember it as being a taxi.
Mm-hmm.
But they ran out of money to do a process shot, which looked like cars flashing.
Yeah.
And they put up Venetian blinds. Now, no taxi in history has had Venetian blinds in the back window. And nobody noticed. I saw the movie when Sidney asked me. I must have seen it a dozen times. Nobody notices, because the drama is so wonderful. And Sidney's point was, production values are important. but not the most important thing. And the greatest CGI effects can't begin to compare with the magic of, for example, the Max Reinhardt version of Midsummer's Night Dream, with just is extraordinary, no CGI effects, very primitive effects, or Ray Harryhausen's The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. And his, today we have movies and novels and poems that are brilliantly produced, that technically they're brilliant, because people are trained better than they may have been trained back in the day when people were making it up as they went along, certainly in film and TV. Film is only 100 years old. TV is only 50 years old. Yeah. But if you don't have something interesting, the effects don't matter. And I just saw a bunch of movies at the Chatham Film Festival, and the two sides of the spectrum, you had Cloud Atlas, $100 million, whatever it cost, and incredible effects, and a snore. Very banal story. It couldn't be more banal. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you had The Sessions with Helen Hunt and John Hawks. I can't remember the guy, the actor's name. Brilliant acting, brilliant script, just a wonderful piece of work. Maybe the best movie I've seen in the past few months. No special effects, except an actor in an iron lung who's twisting his body. The two greatest versions of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde were done by Spencer Tracy and
Frederick March.
And Frederick March. Yeah. And neither of them used special effects to go from Jekyll to Hyde. They just used body language. And I think they're that was one of the many lessons Sidney Lumet taught me. When I went in to start working with him, I had been working in television and movies for about 20 years, and I thought I knew pretty much how to do it. And in the 2 years I worked with him, I learned more than I had in the previous 20 years. And certainly had more fun.
Would he let you write the way you write, or did you ask for direction?
No, Sidney was very... One of the reasons Sidney had brilliant scripts... first of all, he wrote some himself, and he was a brilliant writer. But he would let writers write their passions, which is always a good thing. The great magazines of you know, New Yorker and the at its height, Rolling Stone, when Hunter Thompson did Fear and Loathing, all the great magazines or great publishers, they get great material when they let writers write about what they're passionate about. You can get some clunkers, but Sidney was very good, and we would have we would look at each other's scripts, so he'd be equally willing to let me take a look at his scripts and make critiques. Not so much on the editing. Sidney was always had final cut. He never took a proprietary credit, a film by. And you have young filmmakers who have done their first film and they take proprietary credit. Sidney never took a proprietary credit, but he always controlled the script and controlled the edit. And, of course, controlled the actors. Once halfway through the first year, the 2 years we worked together, he let me edit one of my own episodes, and that was a big deal. I was very, very flattered, and really did as good a job as I knew how at the point that I did it. It also was the week I had my first colonoscopy, and now they film colonoscopies, and I got a tape of the colonoscopy, and I our editor download it onto his Avid, and the scene where a elevated train went into a subway, I intercut my colonoscopy. So for the teaser in Act 1 and Act 2, Sidney was going, very good, you know, not bad, good job, very good choice. And then the top of Act 3, the subway train went into the tunnel, and Sidney took one look and said, "What the hell is that?" And it unleashed the genie from the bottle, because from then on, we started doing practical jokes on each other, which was great, but they were sometimes complicated practical jokes. Never slowed down production.
When you're writing for especially television and you've got recurring characters, how do you set up, because a different writer may come in next week or another year, how do you set up the character and how the character might speak, the character's back history, how do you carry that from episode to episode or year to year?
Well, that's one of the reasons I like TV, because it's a writer's medium. Film is a director's medium or an actor's medium. TV is a writer's medium, because directors come and go, and even actors come and go. I mean, in Law and Order, we killed off actors almost every year to give a sense of mortality in the script, and also to make sure the actors didn't ask for too much money in renegotiation.
Yeah.
What typically happens, there are a couple of different philosophies. The most typical philosophy is the pilot becomes your model, both from, you get a director who is in tune with your thinking, and when writers write for the show, when you hire your staff, you hire people who have a similar sensibility and can tune in. I mean, one of the things you must do as a writer in television is to be able to catch the voices of the characters and the rhythms of the stories. A lot of writers don't give characters different voices. They expect the actors to do that work for them.
Hmm.
And while you can't be as broad as Dickens sometimes, and, you know, every single Dickens character sounds like no other Dickens character. But a lot of that is because he uses ticks. A character will bark as his willing, and the character will keep saying it over and over again to the point where, if it were on television, you want to shoot the actor or the producer. But I think it's a writer's job to catch at least the rhythms, the different rhythms of how different people talk. You can't go overboard, because it could become a cartoon. And that it's the job of the writers you hire to plug into those rhythms.
Hmm.
Most shows have a very narrow spectrum of variability. You really have to, it's a cookie cutter.
Hmm.
I always believe in a show that has a wide spectrum, and Sidney certainly allowed a wide spectrum. We would allow, as long as a writer's got the rhythms and voices of the different characters, we didn't have a cookie-cutter kind of story, which allowed us to have a drama that went from the ultraviolet to the infrared, a very large spectrum of kinds of stories. Some of them were funny, some of them were tragic, some of them were both funny and tragic. That, to me, is more interesting. If you look at a show like Mad Men or The Sopranos, they have a wide, wide spectrum of the kinds of stories, the tone, the registers of how the stories are told, and the tones in which they're told. In Mad Men, I think it was the second year, it may have been the first year, there's a scene where there's a party because they just got an account for a rider mower, and a secretary is riding this white rider mower around, and there's a lot of hilarity, and people are drunk, and there's a moment when there's a slapstick scene, and you're not quite sure what's happening when one of the rider mowers goes out of control, and you see three women in crinoline, you know those dresses mm-hmm. with crinolines, kind of late 50s, early 60s dresses. And suddenly they're spattered with bright color, and you realize, both as you're laughing and being horrified at the same time, that the rider mower has gone out of control and just chopped off a guy's foot.
Mm.
Brilliant.
Mm.
And it's only a show that allows for a wide spectrum of tone could you get that kind of complex moment where it's both hysterically funny and slapstick and melodramatic and tragic all at the same time?
Is that something, I mean, we're talking AMC, but if you were to talk ABC, for instance, as a network, can that kind of scene carry over, or...
Yes. I think it's in some ways harder. The opening up, and I've always, I'm a First Amendment absolutist, and I'm a great believer in you know, whatever works. I mean, all a creator's job is to keep the audience attentive, mm-hmm. and to keep them turning their page of a book, to keep them watching a movie or a TV, to keep them listening at a concert, and all's fair. The longer I've been in the business, however, the more I've become a conservative, theoretically a radical, whatever you can, if you can make it work, it works. Mm-hmm. But in my own work, much more conservative, believing that there's a reason why representation in art, melody in music, and plot in fiction has lasted, mm-hmm. because it helps to keep your audience attentive. In narrative, there's a difference between plot, which is what a writer makes the characters do, and story, which is what the characters do once they're created. In Henry IV, the plot has Prince Hal hanging out with a bunch of reprobates led by Falstaff. The story is everything that goes on between Hal and Falstaff, which is beyond the just what happens next. I find very often I'll finish writing something, whether it's a novel or a script, and I'll know what the plot is because I'll have really worked on the outline, what happens next. But I won't know what the story is, and I very often finish something and then spend some time, if it's a novel, I might even spend a couple of weeks trying to figure out what is the story, mm-hmm. and I'll go back to archetypes. By the way, there's no such word as archetypical. It drives me crazy. Archetypal. Go back to archetypal stories, whether they're biblical stories, Abraham and Isaac, or the Tower of Babel, or fairy tales, Little Red Riding Hood, or myths, Prometheus. And usually you can figure out what your story is. You go, oh, right, this is Abraham and Isaac. I was talking, I do a week-long seminar at Harvard at Kirkland House about storytelling, and I was just back 2 weeks ago, and I was talking to the group, and I was thinking for the first time about silent movies and sound and talkies. Mm-hmm. Someone had asked a question, and when talkies came in, a lot of the filmmakers thought this was not an advance, that it was a distraction, that for one thing, silent movies were a global narrative. Mm. You didn't, any language in the world you could watch, yeah. because it was silent. And we were talking about biblical stories and story versus plot, and I realized that one story about the what happened next in 1928, 1929, 1930 was the Tower of Babel. Hmm. That you had a global medium which had the tremendous power to bring people together, because it was a visual language, and then suddenly, because of talkies, language confounded us all.
Let's switch over to novels, and. David, I would almost guess, and tell me if I'm wrong, you sound like the type of writer who can have multiple projects that you're working on going on at the same time. Is that true?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what I thought.
Yeah. No, I very often, at the very least, have a novel and a screenplay of some sort. And there have been times I've had two novels, or a novel and a nonfiction book, a teleplay, or working on a television mm-hmm. show, and working on a screenplay, and doing journalism. And I find I can do about 3 or 4 hours at a shot on a single project a day. And if I take a break, I could do another 3 or 4 hours on another project. I don't want to do the same project because I don't want to, you know, empty the well. I had grown up a working class kid, and I've worked in factories. And if I don't work at least 8 hours typing, you know, doing the actual art of writing, I feel like I haven't justified myself for that day.
Well, if you're, since you do a lot of traveling, let's say you don't have access to a laptop or a computer, do you do longhand?
Well, I almost always carry a computer with me or get a computer. I have done longhand, but even before computers, I never worked with an electric typewriter. I worked with a standard typewriter, which, by the way, are coming back. I noticed Staples now is 2
really
typewriters that they're selling, and I meet a lot of kids who are in their late teens, early 20s, who are reacting against the electronic media surrounding us, and they're going back to typewriters. I would love to, because the rhythm of my writing changed when I went from a typewriter to a computer. But the advantage of being able to cut and paste and edit is just, I could not go back easily. I could go back, but not easily, to a typewriter.
This may be an unfair question to ask, but do you have a favorite book that you've written? When you're daydreaming, you just happen always, more often than not, go back and think about this one novel.
I don't pay much attention. I don't reread the stuff I write. I don't usually watch the stuff. I watch it in production and make sure the edit is right. But once it's being broadcast, I won't watch it. Usually my favorite is something that I'm working on. Mm. And I just delivered a novel a few weeks ago, and just delivered a new pilot to a division of USA, UPC, a couple of weeks ago, the third draft. And I'm starting a new novel and working on 2 new pilots. But there's one story, I think it's a novella, and it's a story I've wanted to tell for 20 years, and I may take some time out to do it. It's a reinvention of a fairy tale. And the one thing I'm aware of as I get older is realizing I've got to prioritize. There are certain stories I really want to tell. And as someone who had 3 heart attacks in 7 weeks 2 years ago, I want to make sure I get some of these things done.
Now, I certainly, that mortality aspect of you're only going to produce as much as you can while you're alive, must keep you going, since you want to keep writing.
Yeah, I like telling stories. So, and the hardest thing in the world is to sit down, even after decades of doing it, to sit down and start writing in the morning is hard. It's hard facing a blank screen or an empty page. And a day has never gone by when I don't think, I've forgotten how to do it, I never knew how to do it, it was a fluke when I did do it. But once I get started, all that, it's like maybe stage fright, and then once you get on stage, it goes away. But it's hard. I mean, it's always surprised me how physically hard the act of writing is. If I'm writing for 3 or 4 hours at a stretch, I'll get up and my muscles will ache. And it's not just from sitting and being tense or whatever. I think there's some kind of muscular involvement that you get when you're writing about people in action, and action equals character. There's only action. I used to start classes by shooting fire from my fingers, care of Tannen's Magic Store in New York, and tell people, the people who were in the class, to write down not what they thought or what they felt, but what they did. And then to read, just one sentence, and then to read, go around the room reading what people did. And the variety of what people did was remarkable. And of course, there was variety because people are different. Action equals character. And then I would show them how to do the magic trick and have them write down not what they thought and not what they felt, but what they did. And that shows character. As the same character can behave differently under different situations. And in terms of craft, virtually everything else is a footnote to that. Action equals character. The only other important thing for someone who wants to tell stories is to do it.
Hmm.
If you write, you should always write for the same amount of time every day in the same location. And if you're traveling, make wherever you are look like your location at home. My kids used to tease me because if we were traveled, I'd make my desk, even if it's a card table, look like my desk at home. Just for the habit of it. Habit is very powerful. And if you work typically 1 hour a day, don't work 2 hours. If you work 6 hours a day, don't work 5 hours. Do the same amount every day in the same circumstances at the same time and at the end of the year. And do at least one page a day.
Good.
And don't worry about whether it's following or good or bad. Get it done, then get it good. At the end of the year, if you do one page a day, you've got 365 pages, which is a novel or 3 screenplays or 6 teleplays or whatever.
Can you write with chaos going on around you?
I need chaos. partly because I had 2 kids in the house when I was writing for a good part of my life, and I just like it. It's a lonely business. So if you're in the middle of chaos, I also, when I write, I listen to music very loud, usually.
Wow.
As close to vaudeville music as I can get, just because those are my roots. When I was 6 years old, my father was best friends with the manager of one of the last vaudeville theaters in America, the Court Square Theater in Springfield. And I used to hang out backstage, and it was magical. I mean, especially when the acts would stop and then the screen would drop and I would watch the movie from behind the screen, which was fun.
Mm.
And one of the gymnasts, a woman, I remember named Trudy T to this day. I was 6 years old and she captured my heart. Mm. She was the most glamorous thing I'd ever seen. And years later, I took her story and the story of an ingenue I was working with, at a summer stock theater company, SAG, Equity, an actress named Cancino, and put them together to use as a chapter in one of my novels, and missed the most important thing, which was Cancino I worked with when I was 12, and I used to walk by her dressing room towards my dressing room. It was not the most direct route, but she usually had a door open, and she was in her underwear, and 12, even though it was a much more innocent time, I knew that was interesting.
Yeah.
I wasn't quite sure why necessarily. And one day, as I approached her dressing room, I heard a woman sobbing. And I looked in, and there was a woman sitting in Cancino's dressing room, sobbing and sobbing. And she was complaining about how some guy had done her wrong. And she looked over and saw me peeking and said, "You wouldn't treat me like that, would you, kid? Come here." And she grabbed me and pulled me to her ample bosom. And it's the first time I remember as a kid smelling drunk adult. She reeked of gin. But she said, "You wouldn't treat me like that, would you? Come on, let's get married. Come on, let's get married. You and me, let's just forget the show. We'll go get married. Or we'll get married after the show. What about it? How about the kid?" And when I wrote the chapter based on Cancino and Trudy T, I left out this woman who Cancino introduced me as her sister, Margarita. Years later, decades later, after the novel came out where I left out Margarita Cancino, I was traveling to L.A. reading City of Nets by Otto Frederick, a book about Los Angeles, and came on a chapter called The Dancing Cancino Sisters.
Hmm.
and found that Margarita Cancino, who asked me to marry her when I was 12, was Rita Hayworth.
Wow.
So I should have said yes.
Yes, absolutely. When you were talking about listening to vaudeville, I wonder if that has translated into some kind of rhythm that is in your writing.
I think so. I think my sensibility certainly is very influenced by, you know, vaudeville and post-vaudeville-like acts. Like the if I could write anything, and I can't, I'd write Crosby, Hope, Road movies, which I think are...
I love those.
Wonderful, yeah. Wonderful. And a lot of the great comedians like George Burns, and I mean, in the beginning of the Burns and Allen show, one of the first movies on TV, the whole conceit of the show is that Burns would step out of the stage set, the teleplay set, and lean against a proscenium wall and talk about what was going on inside the show. He'd break the fourth wall, very Brechtian. And then later on the show, he'd go up to his study and watch on a television, the Burns and Allen's television show, what was going on camera when he wasn't there, of course. The camera was watching him, watching the TV, watching what was being broadcast from the kitchen. Television hasn't caught up to that yet.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, wouldn't he basically say after his outside of that fourth wall... He would go back, well, let's go back and see what else is going to happen. What's next going to happen?
Yeah, it was great, very concept. Very sophisticated and brilliantly done. And his timing, of course, he was one of the great comedians because of his timing. And a lot of that, I mean, I don't write vaudeville-y stories, but the rhythms of and the conception, I think, come very much from what I learned from both vaudeville being in the theater and watching movies that found their origin in vaudeville.
Can we talk about this book that you brought into the studio today?
This is a new book. It just, I think, been published. I got it just a couple of days ago. I think it's just published in the past couple of weeks. It's called The Quest for Cardenio, Shakespeare, Fletcher, Cervantes, and the Lost Play, edited by David Carnegie and Gary Taylor by Oxford University Press. Gary Taylor is one of the leading, I think the leading Shakespearean critic alive. He is the co-editor of the Oxford Shakespeare and the editor of the Oxford Complete Middleton. And he is brilliant. I mean, I've written three fan letters in my life. One was to him. One was to Billy Crystal after Mr. Saturday Night. And I'm forgetting. I feel like Rick Perry. I'm forgetting. Whoops, I forgot the third one.
Yeah.
And I got to know Gary, and over the years, he mentioned this lost Shakespeare play, Cardenio, that he was working on trying to find a way of figuring out what the original script was like. There exists a rewritten version about 150 years after it was first produced in Shakespeare's time. And it's from a section of Don Quixote, which was the big bestseller when Shakespeare was alive. I said, well, let's put it on. So he brought a copy of his a draft of the play, his version of Cardenio, and I gathered together a bunch of actors. Whoopi Goldberg played Don Quixote. Richard Dreyfuss played Sancho Panza. We had Sam Waterston and Laurie Singer and Jimmy Naughton and all-star cast, and we did it not for public. It was just done in Tom Fontana's living room. Tom is the creator of Oz and Homicide, and most recently the Copper, the wonderful series about a New York City Civil War police detective that's on now. Great series. Everyone should watch it. And it was interesting, and it was also exciting because it was really the first time in since Shakespeare's day that this play had been performed in this form. Hmm. And then I think the following year, we brought it up to Williamstown for a stage reading. And I'm hoping that maybe somewhere like Shakespeare in Company will do a full version of it. It's been done all around the world now. It's in Japan and a number of different countries. And Gary would be is just a brilliant, brilliant scholar and someone who's very alive. He's the only Shakespeare scholar I know who's written talking about Caliban and King Kong as part of the same archetype. And I think he's absolutely right. And Gary looks like an Elizabethan. He looks like Johnny Depp in Pirates of the Caribbean. So he actually lives in and of Shakespeare's era. He's maybe the smartest man I've ever met.
There was a film, Anonymous, that came out about Shakespeare, or the idea that someone else was Shakespeare. Is there any validity, do you think, to that?
I, from my point of view, all you have to know is one of the first promoters of that idea was a man named Looney.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it goes back. It's a class-based criticism that people cannot believe that someone who did not go to Oxford or Cambridge was not part of the Cambridge wits, the literary elite back then, could have ended up as the brand name Elizabethan playwright. But it was an extraordinary time. I mean, first of all, I think the Will Shakespeare who lived in Stratford and who left his will, in which he left his second best bed to his wife, is the same Will who wrote the plays, because he had the same wit. Obviously, we can't be for sure, know for sure, but I believe the second best bed was the best bed in the house, but Shakespeare was smart to know that the first best bed was his grave.
Oh.
And that's the same kind of wit that whoever wrote the Shakespeare plays. And there is so much, we don't know a lot about Shakespeare, but we know a lot about him, enough about him.
Yeah.
And the Heming and Condell, who gathered his plays together, who were co-actors with him, published the plays under his name. I mean, I'm a great conspiracy theorist. I don't think Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone gunman, but I think this Shakespeare conspiracy theory is a bridge too far. But it was an extraordinary time. Almost all the playwrights of Shakespeare's era wrote at least one play comparable to Shakespeare's plays. Gary Taylor thinks Middleton was Shakespeare's equal. I think Webster and Fletcher were, certainly, up there. The reason why Shakespeare became 150 years after his death, for 150 years nobody thought much about Shakespeare, and then the Romantics rediscovered him and he became a brand name like Coca-Cola, partly because of David Garrick promoting him. But that era was so extraordinary, and it was no more than 60 years long. Probably more like 30, but you can stretch it to 60 before the theaters were closed under Cromwell. And the reason, and then when the theaters reopened, nothing like the epic size of the Elizabethan plays were staged again until movies came in. Most plays became plays that took place in someone's parlor or they just didn't have the kind of grandiosity or grandeur that the Elizabethans had until D.W. Griffith and those guys, DeMille. But it's interesting that the two countries which developed very successful theaters, England and Spain. And remember, before the Elizabethans, there was no theater. There were traveling troupes who did morality plays and Bible mm-hmm. plays and courtyards. But suddenly, those two countries who were both minting money in the New World had developed leisure class audiences. And suddenly the leisure class, from apprentices to the rich, started looking around for entertainment. Mm-hmm. And they started going to see plays and theaters. And so there was an explosion in jobs for playwrights and actors. Mm-hmm. And if the Armada, Spanish Armada, had won and beat the British, we'd all be reading Lope de Vega. Not Shakespeare.
Is there a new media or medium for you, do you think?
I don't know about new. There may be new ways of using the old medium. I did, Richard Dreyfuss and I put together after I worked with Sydney for 2 years, a live TV show that PBS produced 2 episodes of. And because it was, you know, we rehearse the actors for a week or so and then bring in the crew just for a tech rehearsal one day instead of filming an hour-long show over 6 or 7 days, we filmed it over 2 days, a tech rehearsal and taping. And because of that, we brought the cost down from an average $3 million per hour-long episode to $750,000 per hour-long episode. And we got, you know, Rita Moreno and Rosie Perez and Blair Brown and Jay Thomas, an extraordinary group of actors.
This is Cop Shop.
This is Cop Shop. And we got great reviews. The L.A. Times called it the new golden age of television. We got a lot of reviews. I mean, for a very limited, it was just 2 episodes without a lot of advertising, but we got an enormous reaction. All raves, and it was the cheapest hour-long show around. And I retained the rights, even to the first 2 episodes that PBS broadcast, because we knew they weren't going to continue with the series, and I wanted to do it as a series. And we couldn't sell it. Now think, instead of $3 million an episode times 22 episodes, we had $750,000 an episode times 22. That's a huge savings over a year-long series. And we had great reviews and stars. Nobody bought it. And I finally had a drink with a friend of mine in the business and who was on the network side, and he said, I'll tell you the reason you're not selling it. People can't steal enough from your budget to make it worth their while.
That's what I was thinking. Maybe if it was a $5 million per episode budget,
yes.
It'd be on today.
Right, and give everyone their own car and driver.
Well, David, we could continue talking, I think, for a very long time, but unfortunately our hour has come to a conclusion, unfortunately. So thank you, David Black, for being on WGXC today for the Art of the Hudson Valley, and I think I'll just have to have you come back.
I would love to. Thank you for having me on.
And thank you all for listening to the Art of the Hudson Valley. This is Chad Weckler, your host. I'll be back next month, and I just want to remind all our listeners to create. just keeps going. That was awesome.